I'm so glad you're with us here on the Clark Howard Show, where it's all about you and that wallet of yours. I want you to learn ideas from me so you can keep more of what you make. Coming up in just a few minutes, an airline abandoning a child and not telling the parents they've done so? Wait till you hear today's Clark Rage. And coming up yet later, enormous changes coming in how we get around and how we pay to get around. I'm going to fill you in on some of that, how it's going to affect your life and your wallet in pretty much any place in the United States. So a lot of stuff going on with the mortgage market. If you're not aware, there are a number of signals that have economists buzzing about whether or not we are headed towards a recession. And one of the effects is that people whose money chases lower risk, which it tends to be what people are doing when they're investing in what are known as bonds, that people that are putting money in bonds are now seeking less money in long-term bonds as an interest rate than short-term, which historically, with almost no exceptions, has indicated that a recession is coming. So that has had an effect directly on what you and I pay for a mortgage. So it's been a while, but now we're moving back into a territory where rates may be low enough for some people to refinance, especially if you're willing to do a 15-year loan refinance rather than refi into another 30-year loan. In addition, for people buying a home, interest rates at a time and this year when rates were expected to move higher are now moving lower, completely the opposite of what the smart money believed. And so it means that with the spring home buying season underway, that you may well be surprised by lower rates. Lenders are having trouble right now attracting enough buyers. And on a lot of loans, lenders are lowering credit standards. Now, that doesn't work out so well long term. But anyway, it means that you may be able to qualify for a loan you might not have qualified for before based on your credit score. But the average credit score required to get a loan has been trending down for a few years and now has taken another dip. So it means the rates are going down, the people who can qualify, the number are increasing. But here's the thing that I want to mention to you, particularly if you're a first-time home buyer. A classic mistake made by home buyers is going to only one mortgage lender, usually recommended by, if you buy new construction, by the representative of the builder, or if you're buying a used home, by a real estate agent, and you only go to one lender. And that's when you are doing what is sometimes referred to as negotiating with yourself. You have no marketplace that you're shopping in. It's really important because if you think about a monthly cost, your mortgage cost is just about the highest thing you have every month. In fact, a lot of people around the country in the high-cost markets, especially on the coasts, are now spending an excess of 50% of their income on their housing cost. And so that shopping for a mortgage becomes exceedingly important. So going to one lender and one lender only means you're going to significantly overpay for the loan you take out, either an interest rate, junk fees, or closing costs, which some of those are junk fees too. So I strongly encourage you to shop. People do this more routinely on a refinance, but it's important to do so on the purchase loan for a home. Where should you shop? Well, it's fine to talk to the lender recommended or mortgage broker or banker recommended by a real estate agent or a builder's representative. That's fine to do. But you also want to shop with credit unions. Credit unions historically, at least historically over the last decade, tend to issue loans at lower costs with lower interest rates than any other source. And so many people overlook credit unions as a place to go qualify for a mortgage that can save you a lot of money. Next thing is for you to talk with a mortgage broker or a banker. It's fine for you to talk with, if you do business with a bank, to talk to the bank. But I will give you a fair warning. The bigger a bank, the worse their mortgage offerings are, and the higher the fees, and also more difficult to qualify with all the bureaucracy at a giant bank. A lot of people like going to Costco as a place to get a loan. I have no problem with going to Costco for a loan on a refi, but I like for you to deal with somebody local when you're doing a loan for purchase of a home. Refis, everything's on the table, including online lenders. But when you're buying a home, I like for you to have somebody who is local in your area, who knows local conditions, and is somebody who is approachable and hopefully responsible for what they do for you. Matt's with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Matt. How you doing?
Good, Clark. How are you doing?
Great.
Thanks for taking the call.
Absolutely. What's going on, Matt?
Well, my question is regarding my company-sponsored 401k. I have been just basically for the last 18 years putting money into it and kind of managing it myself, keeping at least the funds that I am contributing to low-cost index funds. But my question is, I was thinking about having either the company that I have my 401k with manage it through their personal management planning system, or another robo-form or robo-advisor, I guess you would call it.
Is there a particular robo you've been looking at?
Bloom.
Okay, which is the one that has lots of O's in its name, which throws people
right
off. Bloom.
Yeah.
I guess they couldn't get, I don't even want to speculate. I assume it's some kind of flower website that has it properly spelled. So Bloom is an interesting thing because it's a freemium business model to evaluate your 401k and see if you've got the right allocations based on your goals, your age, what you've saved, and what you likely need to save by the time you retire. So they offer for free where they'll analyze using a robo system if you're allocated properly in your 401k. And
right,
that's really great because you'll be able to do basically a checkup. And I would start there. If you feel like you really like the depth of what they're recommending and you want to pay them to manage it, what they do is instead of charging a percent of assets or anything like that, they charge you basically $10 a month to continually manage how you're investing in your 401k.
Correct.
But how old are you?
40 now.
You're 40. And are you planning to retire like in 20 plus years?
Yes.
All right. And tell me how you're allocated right now. What kind of index funds are you in and what percent are you putting in them?
I'm very close to actually to the Bloom profile, which is about 54% in large cap. I've got 15% in mid caps, 14% in international, 9% in small caps, about 5% in my company stock. And then about a percent in bonds, mainly because when the market a few months ago took a big dump, I took my bonds and bought stocks when it was all on sale.
Okay, so you're someone who believes in buy on the dips, and so you move money around where a very tiny percent right now is in bonds.
Yes. And but it's not something I do often.
All right. So an alternative, and you're saying that when you ran yours through Bloom, it said that your mix was pretty close to what they would recommend.
Very close, with the exception is they're looking at 34% for international stocks and 2% for bonds.
Okay.
Short term.
All right. So, you know, you can just do checkups from time to time because it seems you're pretty active with it. I don't know that you need the active management that you'd pay them $120 a year for. So that's really your choice. But I would like you also to look at how the target retirement funds from the big three, Fidelity, Schwab, and Vanguard, how they allocate based on you being roughly 25 years from classical retirement age.
Oh, okay. I got you.
And see if you're carrying too much risk right now as far as they're concerned with your mix of investments. On the thing with international, I am a big fan of the international investing as a portion of what you do. We represent, in the United States, 4% of the world's population. We represent around 20% of worldwide economic activity. And that means 80% of activity is elsewhere in the world. And the economies are growing much bigger in much of the rest of the world than they grow here. So that's why you see that big push towards getting you to do much more international than you're doing right now. Teresa's with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Teresa.
Hi, Clark. How are you?
Great. Thank you, Teresa. You have a relic of the past that you either carry around or store in a drawer. What is that?
Credit cards.
But what kind of credit cards are sitting around?
Well, there's a bunch of major credit cards. There's a bunch of clothing credit cards, gas credit cards, furniture store credit cards. And I just kept shoving them in the drawer. I thought if I didn't activate some of them that it wouldn't affect my credit score. I was going to close all of them. I'm 68. My husband's in his early 70s. We don't owe anything. We own our house outright. We own our cars outright. But I wondered why my credit score wasn't higher than it is. So when I got a credit history, all these credit cards are open, even the stores that are no longer in business.
So that is not necessarily a problem, although store cards are looked at as junk credit.
Uh-huh.
Real credit is considered to be Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover, when you look at accounts. Those that are like single issue for a particular store or gas station or whatever, those are not considered to be good credit. But
okay.
What is your score that you saw?
I think it was 490.
490? 490? That's almost impossibly low.
Maybe it was 5. I'm sorry. I meant to have the sheet here, and I don't. I'm sorry. It was higher than that.
Yeah, because it should be a lot higher than that based on you successfully paying off your mortgage. You have no car loans, and you're current on whatever credit cards you use, right?
Correct.
Okay. I'm betting your score is a lot higher than that.
That's awful. I'm so sorry. I meant to have that here.
That's okay. That's okay. But I want you to circle back. We're going to check back with you and see where your score is to see if there is anything you need to be doing differently. I'd also like you, in the meantime, to sign up for a Credit Karma account, where you will be able to see, they have a tutorial and they'll show you what your scores are based on their method, what your credit looks like. And I'm betting you're going to find that your credit is okay. So again, I want you to sign up for that and come back to us. Let us know what score you actually have or scores you'll have, because you'll see two with Credit Karma. And then I'll have a better sense and feel for if there is a recommendation I need to make for you and to you about your credit.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Okay, I don't even know what to say. Have airlines completely lost every sense of humanity? Have you heard the story about Spirit Airlines, the mom and the son and the daughter flying, and Spirit, unless you pay for seat assignments, you could end up spread apart. So the daughter ends up, 15-year-old ends up in the front of the plane. The mom and the son end up in the back, and they're halfway to their destination when the mom goes up to talk to the daughter. The daughter's not there and is cavalierly told by a flight attendant, "Oh, we were oversold. We put your daughter off in Tampa." And that's the first the mom knew. I mean, panic beyond belief. The daughter allegedly tried to talk to the mom. They said, "No, you have to get off the plane right now. You can't go talk to your mom." Nobody went back to tell the mom. Spirit's being sued, and they say it's our practice not to comment on pending litigation. Now, that's ridiculous as a statement. And then we've got Virgin Australian, that stranded a 9-year-old, unaccompanied 9-year-old, when a flight had to divert. And when they put people on other planes, the kid had no status with the airlines. They left him there behind and left him in unstaffed, it wasn't a storage room, although it looks like it. It was some kind of supposedly lounge, and left the kid there overnight. I mean, what is going on? I know that airlines are busy. I know they see so many passengers every day. And I know that airlines teach their employees that only people who pay big money and have special status matter. But that is ridiculous. And being human and humane is so important. I don't know what we need to do, because the answers, I hate for the idea, the answer to be that government passes some kind of regulation or there's a law or rules. But we had to do that because of airlines leaving people on planes endless hours. And that's when the tarmac delay rule was put into effect. And then airlines screamed and yelled, and it turned out they were able easily to comply. And it's very rare anymore that passengers are left stranded on a plane more than 3 hours today. Why even 3 hours? But this is simple. Just treat people with respect and dignity and treat them right. Why don't you? Thanks for coming and joining us here on the Clark Howard Show, where it's about you and that wallet of yours. I want you to learn ideas from me so you can save more and spend less. And don't let anyone ever rip you off. You have a question for me? Go to clark.com/ask. We got lots of ways for you to ask your questions. There's also a box there you can check if you want to ask your question directly to me. All right. We have a problem in the United States that I've addressed for many years. And I've talked about how Domino's has done this publicity thing where they go around and repair potholes, and how there are these groups of citizens in various communities that usually on Sundays will meet Sunday morning and go out, and they'll attack potholes and they'll hot patch them or whatever. Because when you drive around, it is amazing how much roads have deteriorated in so many places around the country, where the idea of getting a smooth ride is becoming a less and less frequent thing. And I drive a route where I bounce along, and you talk to people talk about, well, you think there are a lot of potholes in your neighborhood. Well, listen to what I'm going through. And you may remember a few years ago, I told the story about hitting a pothole big enough to swallow the front of my vehicle. And it busted the rim, blew the tire out. And it's just a fact that we're having to spend money to repair our vehicles because basic road maintenance isn't taking place. So I want to tell you what's going on around the country with that. In the states, a huge number of states have increased gas taxes. And it hadn't mattered where that state is on the political spectrum, state gas taxes have been going up. And now I saw an item in the Wall Street Journal that Republicans are very interested in raising gas taxes and are trying to get Democrats on board for a tax increase. And the business community and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce are trying to give politicians cover for raising the federal gas tax to maintain roads and bridges. And the argument is made the gas tax was last increased 26 years ago. And the cost of fixing roads has gone up, obviously, over 26 years. And we have more lanes paved and more bridges that have been built. So I'm curious if you have a better idea. One thing we'd have to do, more and more people are doing what I'm doing and buying electric vehicles. And so we free ride on roads that are maintained by federal dollars because we're not paying the gas tax as an electric vehicle driver. And we're going to see millions of electric vehicles on the roads in the United States over the next several years. And we have to have a mechanism where I don't get to ride free on the backs of your purchase of a gallon of gasoline. My vehicle, when I register it each year, I pay a state substitute tax since I don't pay gas tax at the pump. So the state's getting no gas tax from me for its gas tax. And the writer of the bill that became law was somebody who didn't like electric vehicles. So he set it at three times what the equivalent gas tax would be for a gas engine vehicle. And then it goes up every year. So I'm a fan of paying for my fair share. I'm not so fond of paying three times what I should be paying. But we have to come up with a way to pay for what we use. And I know a lot of people think, well, you should just have tolls. Oregon tested many years ago a system where you'd pay per mile that you drove. And that was abandoned. That pilot was abandoned after a while because people didn't like the infringement on their privacy. But making sure that we have enough money to maintain our infrastructure is something we've got to do. We have the largest budget deficit running right now in the history of the country. So we can't just spend money we don't have. So I'd love your ideas on how you would pay to maintain the roads and the bridges of our country, because it's ridiculous that we don't maintain them well. And it's not our job to make sure that we keep auto mechanics busy fixing vehicles that have been damaged by our crummy roads. Sally's with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hi, Sally. How are you?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm good.
Sally, you are helping your son do something. What's that?
So we are helping him purchase a house, and I'm not sure the best way to go about it so that we all benefit from this arrangement. He doesn't have the money for the down payment or the 20%, so we would like to put down the 20% and either A, just finance it all ourselves and rent it to him, or if there's a way to give him that money, and then I don't know if we would both be on the title and he just apply for the mortgage, or I'm trying to figure out a way we both can win.
Yeah, so this gets very complicated and very messy. So you are going to sacrifice and put up money so that your adult son can own a home.
Yes. However, only if there's a way that we can benefit from this. If I can, that's why I thought maybe if I just purchased the home outright, or not outright, but financed it and rented it to him, he would still be benefiting. And he, with the idea of renting two rooms to friends. So,
All right. So how much money has your son saved?
He has about $10,000.
And what kind of price point house is he looking at?
It's about 200.
So you'd be, in order to get to 20%, you'd be putting 30,000 down.
Yes.
So it'll be up to the lender what how they would look at this, but what you can do in many cases, and you would benefit only from the interest you would charge your son, is there's a loan product called an 85-15, where there's an 80% traditional first mortgage. Your son would be putting 5% down, and you would be in second position with a second mortgage that you would lend him the other 15% of the money. What the lender is looking for is they're looking to know that their risk is limited to the 80% threshold, where their exposure is very low in the event your son can't pay. For you, what it means is you come in second position if your son didn't pay, but you would be charging him an interest that must be an arm's length. So the IRS sets out every month what an arm's length rate would have to be. And so you would be carrying back a note. That's the cleanest way for you to do it if your goal ultimately is for him to have a place of his own that ultimately he would own.
Okay.
Now, if you want to do more, are you in a position that you can just buy the house, or would you have to borrow money if you were trying to buy a home of $200,000?
It would be a stretch to purchase it outright. I'd rather not tie everything up. I don't have a mortgage on my house. I own it outright, so it would be the only mortgage I would hold.
Okay. Because if he's an adult and he's out working and all that, and he's managed to save 10 grand, I would much rather him ultimately own the home. If you buy the home and then rent it to him, technically you would be a landlord, it would not be your principal home. You would be subject to paying a higher interest rate on the money you would borrow, because then it's looked at as investor-owned real estate. And your son is not really any better off than he would be just renting from someone else. I'm just not excited by the idea of what you're thinking through.
Okay. Well, my head is racing with different ideas. I can't figure out a nice, clean way to do it.
The cleanest way to do it is what I asked you that won't work for you. And that is for you, if you were in a position to pay for the home,
mm-hmm.
And then he would have a note from you, that he would have a mortgage that he paid you every month. And then that would certainly benefit you, and it would benefit him because he'd be able to buy a home with only 5% down that he has, and he'd be paying you a mortgage payment every month, and you'd be earning much more on that mortgage than you could earn on money in a savings account or CD.
Okay, so you're saying I'm having trouble understanding that. So if I buy the house outright,
he's buying it, you lend the money. So at the closing table, you would lend 95%, you would write at the closing table 95% of the cost of the purchase, and you would then be financing it. You would be like a bank lending him the money.
That's
the cleanest way to do it. I mean, the clean ways to do it are either you just lend him 15% of it so he can qualify for an 80% first mortgage, or that you're in a position that you finance the whole thing and you're the bank lending to him and then he's paying you every month. But
okay.
There's not really, I mean, if he's going to be a renter anyway and he's going to have to bring in roommates, I don't see the advantage to you buying a property, owning it with a loan you take out, and then renting to him. That seems like you're creating a lot of unnecessary complexity in both his life and yours. I don't see the upside to that. Tim is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Clark. It's an honor to speak with you.
Well, great to have you here, and you're looking at buying a new-to-you vehicle. Tell me about that.
Yes. So when I submitted my question, I ended up buying a car just a couple days ago, but we can still explore the options here. I ended up paying a large portion of it in cash, and then I financed the rest. And I'm curious if I can just, I could go back and just pay off the rest of it because I inherited some money. So my question is it better to just pay that car completely off or take some of that money and use it, you know, for other means, investments, 529, that type of thing?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry you lost a loved one and you inherited money as a result.
Thank you very much.
Second, the car loan you took out is at what interest rate?
It's at 3.44.
So then the question about whether or not there's a better use of the money is, would another use of the money earn you more potentially or likely than 3.44%?
So right, that seems to be the issue, yep.
So the money you have that is available to you from the inheritance, is it sitting in a savings account right now?
Currently it is, yeah, waiting for my next move.
So it's earning essentially nothing.
Right, and I will ultimately put it into one of the online accounts once that would be an option.
So even at that, you're going to earn 2.something% versus the 3.44 you're paying. So you mentioned a 529 account. So you have young children?
Yeah, not as so young. That's something I didn't start. A ninth grader and a seventh grader.
Okay.
We do our 401ks, and I used some of the money I got to max out last year's Roth.
Fantastic. And by the way, that's a higher priority than your ninth grader and seventh grader's college fund.
I've learned that from you.
Yeah. So I would say that I would go ahead and take the money that's sitting in idle cash and wipe out that vehicle loan. And whatever your payment would have been every month, pay that amount back into a Roth. And when you run out of room in the Roth, that then you look at putting 529 money aside for the ninth grader and seventh grader.
Okay, that makes sense.
Because as you've heard me say repeatedly in different ways, there are no scholarships for your retirement.
No.
But college costs are so variable. You know, it's so different depending on where somebody goes. They go to community college, what school they attend based on tuition or grants or scholarships or whatever they earn. So saving for yourself is the highest priority. Having that vehicle loan, even though the rate is reasonably low, it doesn't outrun the cash you have sitting. And so I just wipe it out, know that you are free of that debt, own the vehicle you bought free and clear, and then take that cash and build it back up for yourself moving forward. It's time for Ask Clark. That's where you go to clark.com/ask, post a question. Sometimes your question will be posted by Joel or posed by Joel.
That's right, Clark. Mary Grace wrote in. She said, we're selling our home this summer for a military move. Our umbrella policy and flood insurance are up for renewal this month. Is it worth it to renew these coverages if the flood insurance will only cover the property for a few months and our asset mix will change when we sell the home?
Yeah, this is one of those things with insurance, is that even if a policy is prorated, the way it's prorated hurts you for a partial term. But you do not want to, if you have a home in a flood area, if you have the need for an umbrella liability policy, you don't want to leave yourself exposed. And so you just go ahead and know this is one of life's unfairnesses that you pay for a period that you are not going to get full benefit from, even after a proration of refund.
All right. And Charlie says, there's a local office that says that they can reduce my tax debt. It seems to be legit. Can it be true?
So we don't say what kind of tax this is, whether it's income tax or property tax or whatever. It is a legitimate thing in the property tax arena. A lot of commercial properties routinely use property tax appeal services. Individual consumers, residential owners in some places in the country where property taxes are quite high will hire a firm to represent them in an appeal of the value set on a property that in turn sets the taxes. But when it comes to income tax, these quote-unquote services that promise that they will be able to reduce your tax bill are really sleazy and usually straight out scams. Do not trust people who say they are miracle workers and dealing with an unpaid tax due to the IRS or state taxing authorities for income, because it is just a fabrication. If you have a big tax bill you can't pay, or the state or feds allege you do, that's when you hire a tax professional, a tax attorney, or an enrolled agent, or a CPA who does tax to represent you for that problem. You're listening to The Clark Howard Show. Thanks for joining us today. The Clark Howard Show is produced by Kim Drobes, Joel Larsgaard, Deborah Reese, and Jim Ayers. And remember, 24 hours a day, we're there to serve you at Clark.com and ClarkDeals.com.